watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Eco-apocalypse. The life support systems of the entire ecosphere, the planet's thin skin of air, water, and topsoil, are threatened by global warming, ozone depletion, and overpopulation. Global warming is caused by tropical deforestation, power plants, and most of all, motor vehicle exhaust and other fossil fuel emissions that hold the Earth's heat in and create a greenhouse effect, trapping the heat close to the Earth's surface. International panels of scientific experts have voiced their alarm at the accelerated rate of destabilizing climate changes. And what do we have in the U.S.? We have such dangerous fools as former Senator Steve Symes, Republican of Idaho, who said that if he had to choose between capitalism and ecology, he would choose capitalism. The senator doesn't get it, does he? Without a viable ecology, there will be no isms of any kind to choose. The 1990s were the warmest decade on record, with 1997 the warmest year of the 20th century, until 1998, which in turn was surpassed by 1999 and 2000. And the last few years, we also, again, getting record heats. Carbon dioxide, the most common of greenhouse gases, has increased by about 25%. Since the mid-1800s. These buildups are altering the climatic patterns on which we depend for our rainfall, resulting in meteorological aberrations across much of the planet, including record hurricanes and windstorms. Global warming is causing the Arctic ice caps and the Greenland glaciers to melt at an accelerated rate, affecting a rise in sea levels that is already beginning to inundate shorelines and small islands and bring severe floods, droughts, and disrupting natural ecosystems. In northern climates, as well as warmer ones, rising temperatures have diminished soil moisture, thereby disrupting the ability of forests to renew themselves and contributing to more forest fires. Global warming is playing havoc with the breeding habits of wildlife and threatening species with extinction through the release of new viruses and increased vulnerability to disease. Global warming also puts humans at risk by inflicting more heat, stress, air pollution, infectious disease, and droughts. Unless we can move away from fossil fuels and toward wind and solar power, the compounding effects of global warming are likely to bring utter disaster to the entire planet. Another potential catastrophe is the shrinkage of the ozone layer that shields us from the sun's deadliest rays. About 2.6 billion pounds of ozone-depleting chemicals, chiefly chlorofluorocarbons, are emitted into the Earth's atmosphere every year. The top five CFC polluters in the United States are corporate military contractors. U.S. space shuttles also have disastrously damaging effects on the ozone layer. Yet the space program goes on and on. Capitalism's modus operandi is to produce and sell at an ever-expanding rate, treating the world's resources as limitlessly expendable. But the Earth is finite, as is its water supply, oxygen, topsoil, an ability to absorb toxins, an ability to absorb heat from energy consumption. An infinitely expanding capitalism and a fragile, finite ecology appear to be on a calamitous collision course. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, we aired a talk by Derek Jensen, which I hope you had a chance to hear. If not, I recommend downloading show number 311 from our archive at unwelcomeguests.org. In his talk, Jensen posed a series of questions to us as to what our threshold of toleration is for outrages against ourselves and our ecosystem. He posed this as a series of hypothetical acts by an alien invader, poisoning the land, air, and water, putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk, extinguishing 90% of the large fish in the ocean, to name a few. These listed assaults on the living world, however, are not hypothetical. They are examples of the actual damage done by industrial civilization, what is called our way of life. He repeatedly raised the question, how bad does it have to get before people are willing to do something about it? At a time when sweeping change is needed, those ready to make the change are boxed in by a legal, political, and economic power structure that is fighting to preserve present privilege at the cost of losing the future. Jensen compared the acquiescence to this power structure with the Nazi final solution. He described how the Jewish victims were drawn to their doom in a series of steps that presented compliance with the state as the safer, more rational course. Will you get an ID card or risk being killed? Will you get in a cattle car or risk being killed? Will you take a shower? Jensen emphasized that in the end, the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto that fought back had a higher survival rate than those who went along. He also referred to Robert J. Lifton's research on the Nazi concentration camp doctors. Lifton, a psychiatrist, wanted to understand how it was that so many doctors, respected members of society who were sworn to heal and not harm, justified their participation in death camps. He interviewed many of them after the war, and they told him that they attempted to make life more bearable for the prisoners in whatever way they could. Jensen noted what the Nazi doctors did not do, which was the only thing that would actually help the victims, challenge and destroy the Nazi system that was creating the atrocity in the first place. Both Jensen and the previous week's speaker, Seneca Elder and Professor John Mohawk, targeted the beliefs that underlie Western society as ones that encourage or at least permit widespread environmental destruction. Jensen called this not inhabiting the place we live, and gave as an example how we know intimate details about movie stars or sports teams, but cannot identify edible plants growing near our homes. It seems to me that the failure of the majority to confront power and prevent the preventable, whether genocide or ecocide, resides in the mind rather than in any obstacle of the physical world. What ideas and ideologies are shaping this society's present actions in the world? That will be the terrain of our program this week. For the past two shows, I've been reading to you from the book Beyond the Promised Land, The Myth and the Movement by David Noble, which takes on the core beliefs, the myths that underlie Western civilization. In his book, he targets the story of the Promised Land from the Old Testament as a defining myth and metaphor of Western society, even its secular or oppositional aspects. He identifies the idea of the Promised Land as something that broke with more ancient ideas of our relationship to place. This new idea has spread across the globe with the dissemination of Christianity and Islam, which are built on the Hebrew Bible. Though Christianity and Islam are presently locked in mortal combat, at least in the eyes of some, their similarities are much deeper than their differences when contrasted, for example, with the worldview of Native American cultures, as John Mohawk illustrated on the program a couple of weeks ago. This key difference is a belief that we humans are in this world but not of it, that our goal lies beyond this world, whether in a spiritual sense or physical one, and this informs both the religious and the secular, permitting us the expectation of departing from the mess we created, either via a spaceship or a rapture. It makes us think that we can destroy a village to save it, that we can justify murder of the body of the so-called heretic in order to save the soul. And it views human history as a march of progress, precluding the possibility that we are marching off a cliff. Let me begin the program with another reading from Beyond the Promised Land, The Myth and the Movement by David Noble, an historian from York University in Toronto. This is Chapter 4, titled Heir to the Promise. Noble writes, "As the Hebrews, in the wake of defeat and destruction, appear to have been denied their divine destiny, the emergent renegade sect of Christians appropriated for themselves the mantle of the chosen people and the divine covenant, and with it title to the promised land. By their lights, the mythology of the promised land was utterly detached from place and was instead spiritualized and universalized, and acknowledged outright to be not of this earth. The promised land, at once the restored Garden of Eden and the renewed Imperium of Israel, now became also the ethereal kingdom of God, the heavenly New Jerusalem. According to Hebrew mythology, the promised land had been pledged by God to Abraham and his descendants, a pledge repeated to Isaac and Jacob. Quote, "And I will give unto thee, and to thy seed after thee, the land." Close quote. Thus, all later claimants to the promise had of necessity to trace their lineage back to these patriarchs. Calling itself the New Israel, therefore, the early Christian church placed a marked emphasis upon Jesus' alleged descent from Abraham through David's father, Jesse. In the very first chapter of the New Testament, Matthew recounts this lineage in detail. "The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob begat Judas and his brethren. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David until the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations, and from the carrying away into Babylon unto Christ are 14 generations." Hence Jesus, whose actual historical existence, unverified outside the Gospels, is as doubtful as that of Abraham, represents the otherworldly continuation of the Hebrew story, indeed its culmination. In the Christian view, the advent of Jesus signaled the realization of the promise. Jesus at once represented the second Adam, redeemed progenitor of the Garden of Eden and the Messiah, righteous restorer of the kingdom of Israel. He personified the renewed perfection destined for Abraham, the resurrection anticipated by Ezekiel, the deliverance envisioned by Daniel. Above all, Jesus' resurrection promised life eternal, the conquest of death so desperately desired by but ultimately denied the intrepid King Gilgamesh. The Christians then took the eschatological essence of the Hebrew mythology and triple distilled it into the purest of fantasies, an otherworldly promise of triumph over nature and the limits of human existence that for two millennia has fueled the West's fevered flight from place and the wisdom of the ancients. The last book of the New Testament, Revelations, moreover, foretells the fulfillment of this fantasy in the destruction of the damned and resurrection of the righteous. Mankind's salvation is foreordained, the course of events inevitable. As revealed to Abraham, there is indeed an order to the universe, an unseen harmony in human affairs. One has only to believe, to heed divine commands, and adhere to the predetermined script. The Christian appropriation of the promise divorced the covenant from kinship and rendered all people potentially chosen people, given the requisite faith. The first universalist appropriation of the Abrahamic myth was subsequently followed by a second, the Islamic eruption of the 7th century. Like the Christians, the followers of Mohammed, the supposed last prophet, traced his lineage back to Abraham. through his first son Ishmael, and Moses, and also now Jesus. Abraham is mentioned in nearly a quarter of the Quran's surahs, and he is alleged to have constructed the Holy Kaaba, magnet of Islamic pilgrimage in Mecca. Just as the biblical story begins with Abraham's departure from Haran, so here too the story, and time itself, begins with the Hijra of A.D. 622, Muhammad's fabled flight from his native land of Mecca for Medina, and in emulation of Abraham's blind obedience to the call and law of God, Islam was centered upon an utterly uncompromising monotheistic worship of the one, omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent God Allah, and absolute submission to his laws by means of strict adherence to specified religious practice. For Muslims, the Islamic heirs to the Hebrew mythology, the promise of a great and blessed nation is combined with that of transcendence. Here, too, destiny is predetermined, and a person's life culminates not in death, but in an angelic judgment and potentially heavenly resurrection, eternal bliss in paradise. For the species as a whole, according to some Islamic prophets, but not the Quran itself, time culminates, as it does in Revelations, with the coming of the Messiah, the apocalyptic triumph of good over evil, the end of the world, and the resurrection of the dead. As glimpsed first by the Hebrew patriarchs and prophets, and then by Jesus and the preachers of the gospel, so too the order of the universe revealed to Muhammad and through him to the Islamic faithful, all aspects of existence, including individual and collective human experience, operate according to inherent laws, bestowed upon them by the one and only God. Knowing those laws and submitting to them form the essence of the Islamic faith and the only mortal means of fulfilling the promise. If Christians and Muslims modeled their faith on the unalloyed monotheism of Abraham, the more powerful among them modeled their temporal and distinctly territorial ambitions as well on those of the Hebrews, in particular, the mythical conquest of Canaan with God on their side. If, as some commentators suggest, monotheism succeeded because it overcame the inherent instability and uncertainty of polytheism, that instability and those uncertainties were multiplied many times over by subsequent conflict within and especially among rival monotheisms. As the time came, moreover, a succession of great nations, each identifying itself as the new Israel, competed to impose the beneficence of its particular God upon unbelievers, not by the word, but by the sword. Following the pattern already set by the Militi Christi, Islamic warriors quickly extended the great nation of Allah throughout the Middle East and North Africa, and beyond the Near East as far as India. The emergent West, however, fell to the Christian sword. With the conversion of Constantine in the 4th century, Christianity became the official creed of the Roman Empire, and accordingly, Roman imperial adventures were henceforth interpreted as the divinely ordained advance of the Israelites toward the Promised Land. In striking contrast to St. Augustine, who insisted upon the otherworldliness of the New Jerusalem, the early church historian Eusebius of Caesarea likened Constantine both to Abraham, to whom the promise was given, and to Moses, who led the Israelites to the Promised Land, and maintained that the fulfillment of the promise was made manifest in the glory of Rome. Augustine's disciple Orosius seconded Eusebius' insight, declaring that the role of Rome in the providential plan was that of a chosen nation progressing towards Christ. Roman history, in short, was of a piece with the history of salvation, which was begun by the Israelites of the Old Testament. If the history of empire could be identified with the history of salvation, so too could the history of nations. Thus, in the 6th century, Gregory of Tours identified Clovis, converted leader of the Franks, not only as the new Constantine, but also the new Moses, moving the Franks to the center stage of world history as the heirs of the Israelites. Later, Charlemagne, emperor of the Franks, declared himself not merely the restorer of the Roman Empire, but the new David, restorer of the kingdom of Israel. In England, the historian and monk Gildas identified the Britons in flight from the Romans as the true Israelites who were guided in their trials by divine providence. Likewise, the venerable Bede in the 8th century later saw the Saxons as the new Israel chosen by God to supplant the Britons in the promised land of Britain. Some 4 centuries later, Orderic identified the Norman conquerors as God's chosen people, the true heirs of Israel. Finally, half a millennium later, the Puritans robustly renewed the history of salvation by declaring themselves to be the children of Israel, chosen to deliver the seed of Abraham to the shores of the promised land. In the face of persecution and insurmountable opposition to their establishment of the kingdom of God in England, these militant millenarians in the spirit of Abraham took flight from their native land to live in exile as strangers in a new world. As early as 1609, William Simons called upon his countrymen to go to Virginia, a land he insisted was more like the Garden of Eden than anywhere else on earth. God meant for us to possess it, Simons declared, citing Genesis, quote, "For the Lord said unto Abraham, Get thee out of thy country, unto the land that I will show thee." Close quote. 4 years later, in his report from Virginia, Alexander Whitaker identified the colonists with Israel and the new land as Canaan. If God do promise Abraham that his seed shall inherit the land of Canaan, Abraham's posterity shall after many days in the appointed time be planted peaceably in the land of Canaan. Close quote. Before long, this prophecy was fulfilled, but rather than peaceably, in the most brutal manner of the biblical conquest of Canaan. Heading towards Virginia aboard the Mayflower in 1620, the Puritan pilgrims were swept by a storm north to Plymouth Bay, where they set about to build their new Jerusalem as a city upon a hill. Aboard the ship Arabella 10 years later, John Winthrop, Puritan governor of the New Massachusetts Bay Company, likened his intrepid band of believers to the Israelites entering into covenant with God. Imagining the Atlantic Ocean to be the River Jordan, gateway to the Promised Land, Winthrop directed his party with Moses' farewell exhortation to Joshua just before the conquest of Canaan. "We shall find the God of Israel is among us, and the Lord thy God shall bless thee in this land whither thou goest to possess it." Close quote. In like spirit, the great Puritan divine Increase Mather referred to New Englanders as those whom the Lord has set as watchmen to the house of Israel. Thus began the deeply rooted ideological and psychological association of the United States with the mythological chosen people of Israel, an association that remains at the core of American self-identity. In the wake of the successful American Revolution and thus the creation of this, quote, great nation, Harvard President Samuel Langdon emphasized the importance of holding up the Republic of the Israelites as the example that the American states must follow. While George Washington was alternately revered as Moses and Joshua, both Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin suggested that the great seal of the new nation should bear an allusion of this crossing of the River Jordan. Never was a possession of arms used with more glory or in a better cause since the days of Joshua, theologian Ezra Siles declared in 1783. "The Lord shall have made his American Israel high above all nations. It may have been of the Lord that Christianity is to be found with such great purity in this church exiled into the wilderness of America, and that its purest body should be evidently advancing forward by an augmented natural increase in spiritual edification into a singular superiority, with the ultimate subservience to the glory of God in converting the world. Close quote. Here then is the Old Testament template of all subsequent American history, the telos of a displaced people, forever estranged but chosen by God to possess and destined to deploy upon nature and mankind alike the transformative powers of perfection. In his Plea for the West, published in 1835, Presbyterian preacher Lyman Beecher affirmed this nation's manifest destiny to subdue and conquer a continent. If this nation is, in the providence of God, destined to lead the way in the moral and political emancipation of the world, it is time she understood her high calling and were harnessed for the work. Close quote. Likewise, in defense of incipient U.S. imperialism, politician and historian Albert Beveridge asserted with assurance that God marked the American people as the chosen nation to finally lead in the regeneration of the world. And I'm reading from Beyond the Promised Land, The Movement and the Myth by David F. Noble, Chapter 4, Heir to the Promise. And I continue. The stage is set, the destiny disclosed, President Woodrow Wilson trumpeted at the end of the First World War. It has come about by no plan of our conceiving, but by the hand of God who led us into this way. We cannot turn back, we can only go forward, with lifted eyes and freshened spirit to follow the vision. It was this we dreamed at our birth. America shall in truth show the way. The light streams upon the path ahead and nowhere else. Close quote. In the midst of the Second World War, President Franklin Roosevelt called upon his fellow citizens to, quote, cleanse the world of ancient evils, ancient ills. He continued, we are inspired by a faith which goes back through all the years to the first chapter of the book of Genesis. We on our side are striving to be true to that divine heritage. In 1938, at the outbreak of that war in Europe, the song, God Bless America, which was to become the unofficial U.S. anthem, made its debut. Coincidentally, the composer of the song was a Jewish immigrant from Russia by the name of Israel Balin, by that time already changed to Irving Berlin. In 1954, in the depths of the Cold War against godless communism, Republican statesman John Foster Dulles declaimed, our nation was conceived with a sense of mission assigned by Providence. That same year, in the same spirit, the U.S. Congress decided to add the words under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, to be recited every morning by every student in the nation's schools. In the signing law, President Dwight Eisenhower declared, from this day forward, millions of our school children will daily proclaim in every city and town, every village and rural schoolhouse, the dedication of our nation and our people to the Almighty. Close quote. He also said, our government makes no sense unless it is founded on a deeply felt religious faith. Close quote. Nearly half a century later, a federal appeals court in San Francisco ruled that the Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional because the words "one nation under God" violated the principle of separation of church and state. According to the New York Times, the decision drew howls of protest across the political spectrum. President George W. Bush, reminding his listeners that we received our rights from God, condemned the decision as out of step with American tradition and history. The U.S. Congress roundly condemned the decision, with the members of the Senate voting unanimously for a resolution against it. Later the same day, senators and congressmen gathered together on the steps of the Capitol building to recite the Pledge of Allegiance in unison, in defiance of the court ruling, and sing God Bless America. And I've been reading from Beyond the Promised Land, The Movement and the Myth by David Noble, an historian from York University in Toronto. Coming next, we go from history to the present gathering darkness. Stay tuned.
I grew up in the land of houses and rows. I had asthma, that's how it goes. When you're in LA, there are cars everywhere. See the sky and smell the air. I left home, looked around, trying to find some solid ground. I found life in the northern wood, and I knew that this was good. I saw the dozers, the death machines, tearing apart everything green. I built a platform, sat in a tree, said if you're taking her down, then you're taking down me. I saw the highways, I saw the mall, I saw the eagle, heard the clarion call. The voices of reason were talking to me, so I burned down a couple of SUVs. 23 years, 23 years. Among the words and the deeds, war for the West, a chapter was written, and I was the test to shut us all up and drive us apart. All who have life and love in our hearts. The judge did the math, then he did some more. He was a man out to settle a score. An illegal sentence in a stolen land, with life or death in the palm of his hand. 23 years, 23 years. And now here I am, so long behind bars, for trying to breathe in a nation of cars. Sanity jailed and madness in power. Our time it is short, and now is the hour. So may you hide in the darkness, stay safe in the night, find whatever you need to stay in the fight. There's a planet at stake, and that's all I see. And my thoughts will be with you until I am free. In 23 years, 23 years, in 23 years, 23 years.
And that was Song for Free by David Rovix. To find out more about Free's case, visit freefreenow.org. The Christian soldiers are on the march in America, determined to make their religion law, make women slaves, put the unbelievers to the sword, and bring on the apocalypse. I am not exaggerating, as you will hear in the next interview by Mike McCormick with a minister and a lawyer who organized a forum on Christian fascism last week in Seattle. Here's Mike McCormick.
Reverend Rich Lang is with Trinity United Methodist Church in Ballard. And attorney Bill Hansen is a local attorney and one of the organizers of the World Peace Through Law section of the Washington State Bar Association. He is also one of the original organizers and helped start the first listener-sponsored radio station in the Northwest, CRAB, K-R-A-B. So we're very happy to have you both in the studios. Thanks for coming in. And what we're going to be talking about today is a forum entitled Fascism in America, Is It Coming? And I'll start with you, Rich. What is the motivation in putting together this forum?
Well, I think the motivation is what's happening in our land across the country, and something I've been concerned about since December of 2000, when I think that what we witnessed was a coup in this country. The Florida election being rigged and the Bush forces coming in. And on a personal level, I remember spending the, it was just about over Christmas time when the whole extended family got together, and the in-law part of the family are all pretty right-wing Christian types. And I remember listening to that side of the family talk about how this whole election back in 2000 was a move of God, and the miracle that that Bush became president, and it was a sign of God ordaining this movement, and so good times were ahead, and that and then the events that have just unfolded since that coup just keep piling one on top of another, and then we watched the same or a very similar thing happen in 2004, and now Bobby Kennedy has popularized that with a. Or Robert Kennedy, rather, Jr., has popularized that in an article in Rolling Stone about the fixing of the election in Ohio. And we're coming up to elections in November of this year. And I'm pretty animated because I don't think the regime is going to give up power. And I do think, with Kevin Phillips, that what we now have in the Republican Party is a theocratic party. And I think we have a theocratic movement in this country that I call Christian fascism. And so all of that is motivation to just bring some folks together, Bill here and Joey Pippia and Neil Algie from the Ernst Becker Foundation. And so we're just going to put together a kind of an educational forum looking at the nature of fascism, and also at least a couple of us are going to talk about the religious element in fascism.
All right. And Bill, how did you get interested in this subject matter?
Well, Mike, I got interested a long time ago, in the 1930s, actually. I was brought up in Shanghai, and my father taught political science, and he took us to Berlin to look at what was happening with Hitler and the Nazis for 5 months in 1935. And I witnessed the first bombing of civilians in the Orient, 1937, the Japanese. And all of this brought me to the studio today because I was determined to work on peace and have done some of that. But right now I'm especially interested in what's happening in the United States because it echoes a lot of the things that happened in Germany, Japan, and China as those countries went into fascism.
And your talk today is titled The Economic Fascism of Corporations. So you see a connection between corporations currently here in the United States and fascism?
Yes, and it's something that most people don't want to think about because, one, we Americans properly idealize our own country, and it is a wonderful country, and it's a founding of the first major successful democracy. And Americans are very reluctant to think that there are really major movements in the United States that are anti-democratic. And a problem in thinking about corporations is that it's a very complicated picture. Most corporations in the United States are fine, especially small corporations, especially nonprofit corporations. But what I'm mainly talking about is a group of very large corporations which are not only anti-democratic, but they're profoundly anti-capitalist and anti-free enterprise.
All right, well, maybe we can jump in and define what you both believe is fascism. Because I think a lot of people would say there's no way fascism is going to set foot here in the land of the free and the home of the brave, because that's, you know, they picture fascism as Hitler and the Nazis.
I would define fascism, you know, the a lot of folks take out Mussolini's old word is corporatism. But for me, fascism is when you watch the spheres of power all collapse into one, and the genius of American democracy is that we created checks and balances so that no one sphere and no one elite could basically have total domination. But what we are seeing today is that the executive and the legislative and judicial branches, as well as the media, as well as corporations, as well as the military, and a religious movement are all fusing together on the same talking points, the same message, the same agenda. So I would define fascism as when the different spheres of power all come together wrapped around the same message and the same goal. And an example of that, and I'll end with this, with the religious element, is the theocratic movement in this country, which is called Dominionism, which is becoming a dominant expression of Christianity. It's sometimes, as the listeners are hearing this, you'll hear it at workplace or in your networks. You'll hear people wanting to, you know, take the city for Christ or win the world for Jesus. And that's, in many senses, theocratic code for imposing also a certain moral order on society. And I think that's where the Christian element comes into fascism being used by this fusion of powers, is that you do need a what I would call a sacred canopy to hang over your deeds. People need ultimate meaning. They need a cosmic purpose. And so the religious element is very important, and keeping the right wing at fever pitch is very important. And I think that's what's behind a lot of the cultural wedge issues, including the shenanigans this last week in the Senate with gay civil rights. But one of the ways that this fascism rolls out, if people wanted to see it themselves, you could just Google the if you look at the Republican Party platform in Texas, and I think Texas is a wonderful bellwether state. The Republican Party in Texas is driven by the Christian right. And when you begin to look at the agenda, what their agenda is for our country and for their state, it becomes downright frightening. And just take a minute just to kind of lay this out. Under government, on their party platform, one of the things they say in it is, we want to dispel the myth of separation of church and state. And they've also said that this is a Christian nation. That's their official policy. We further support the abolition of federal agencies involved in activities not delegated to the federal government. And what they're talking about is abolish the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the position of Surgeon General, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Departments of Energy, Housing, Urban Development, Health and Human Services, Education, Commerce, Labor. The thrust of all of that is the hollowing out, the absolute hollowing out of government, until the only function of the federal government is the military, quote, the defense of the nation, and when it comes to Christianity, also the guardian of the national morality. And that's why these gay civil rights issues become very important. So that's just one brief example of the fusion between the religious right and the political right and the agenda that they have for our country.
Bill, would you agree on Rich's definition of fascism, or what is your definition of fascism?
That's a very good statement. I've been looking at definitions of fascism in preparation for our little conference and now for this broadcast, and I find a lot of them deficient because they do concentrate on the idea of leadership of one man that we may call a dictator, and that oligarchy, and Rich has filled in a lot of the additional material of what happens with human beings and what happens with religion. And what I have to present has to do with the participation of business. And in all fascist countries, business has been a very important part of the fascist government. And under the guise of independence and freedom, the businesses and big corporations become instruments of governmental oppression. Right now we have, as I said before in the introduction, a group of large corporations which are not free enterprise, among other things I prepared by looking at Ayn Rand's definitions of government and of free enterprise, of capitalism. And they appear very quaint now, because one of the parts of Ayn Rand's definition that she seems very to be very important is that government does not interfere with business, and the opposite happens with fascism, because business wants government interference and government cooperation all the time. So making a little summary of what now some of these large American corporations are trying to do is, one, they want to have monopoly control over their business area, not free enterprise. They want government preference. They avoid taxes. 71% of American corporations pay no taxes. They want to eliminate American workers if they can, in order to get cheap labor to be more, and they always say it's to be more competitive. They want profits so badly that they're willing to cheat the public in massive ways, Enron, by the billions, in fact. They want wars. They want small wars, because that supports the economy and makes very large profits. They want to support illegal immigration. That's a whole separate issue, but very, very important. It would be very easy for the United States, with $400 billion for its military, the largest in the world has ever seen, and we're the most militarized state the world has ever seen, and it would be very easy, and we could call it, as Bush keeps saying, for the security of the nation, we could guard a 400-mile, essentially desert type of border, and it has not been guarded and is not guarded, and we now have an unbelievable 12 million illegal immigrants, and these corporations and the government want that to happen. It's not because we can't guard the frontier. It's because that's desired, and it's very simple to see that this busts unions and keeps wages down. And among other things, it destroys the idea of affirmative action because many of these people are instantly aware of and are eligible for the whole affirmative action pattern. And so we have illegal aliens as using affirmative action to get jobs, et cetera, et cetera, and squeezing out the local people. So there's a kind of a summary of how I see business, and as I said before, not all corporations, but some of these large corporations, as fitting in with the state and being opposed to free enterprise.
I think some signs of that should deeply trouble us, that's happening politically in this country, is to watch how Bush, in particular, but this is also backed by the whole movement and certainly the Republican Party, and not very well recovered in the corporate press. But when legislation is passed, you know, they now have this doctrine of these signing statements, where essentially the legislation, no matter what it says, is then reinterpreted to mean what the agenda of this administration wants it to mean. And I think, that moves, again, it consolidates power, it centralizes power, it doesn't allow the checks and balances that are the best of democracy to operate. I'm also concerned, again, as we move towards the elections and this November, with the touchscreen voting machines, and how many elections are we going to? How many electoral cycles are we going to go through until we simply cannot have any confidence in our vote and in our electoral process? And the significance of that, excuse me, is how little that's reported on, how little analysis, and so how little that's talked about in the public square. And this atrophying of checks and balances, the atrophying of the public voice, I think is a huge red flag. And if we don't get on top of that, we're basically, I think, one terrorist strike away from the clamping down of all civil rights. And for America to have descended to that point should be of great concern to all of us. And the frustration, at least that I have, is there doesn't seem to be any political party that wants to take those concerns on. And I find that the Democratic Party is in many senses just disgusting, in that they will not look at some of the underlying cultural issues that are happening and at least acknowledge that they're out there. And so somehow we have to build a movement of people power to put pressure on our political parties, both Democrat and Republican, to start articulating some of the discontent at deep cultural levels.
So would you say we're on the road to fascism as opposed to saying that we've already arrived at its shores?
No, I think we're on the road. I mean, there's still some freedom here, but it's getting scary. I mean, just, in the last couple of weeks, the increase in warrantless wiretapping, the legislation that really curtails whistleblowing on a federal level. I remember when the Patriot Act was first passed after 9/11, how everybody reassured us about sunshine or sunset laws or whatever they were. Well, everybody knew, and sure enough, it's come to pass. And again, the continual gutting out of government in sense of money financially, It's ludicrous that we're talking about the estate tax again. It's just ludicrous. And so these concern me because I don't hear or see a political party, in this case the Democratic Party, being in opposition to the general drift towards the consolidation of power. And what I'm getting at is, you know, I could see if suddenly we had a Democratic renewal and the Democrats were swept into office and they even won the presidency in 2008. What I wonder is if the real lesson is to just continue this drift towards fascism under a Democratic Party regime. And I'm worried about that.
Bill, give us some more perspective on this, because you mentioned early on, and you actually had gone into a little more detail when we were off mic but before the interview, about the Japanese bombing of, I believe it was Shanghai when you were a kid, and you were pointing out that the planes had been built by Mitsubishi, which was this special conglomeration of companies and entities.
Let me give examples of what I'm talking about and what we're talking about in this program of how fascism develops and how it has developed, and it's very sharp as education to learn what happened in China, Japan, and Germany. And as to the events of 1937, the Japanese, you know, had a nascent democracy with a parliament that they called a diet. And in the late 20s and early 30s, the right-wingers in Japan just started to kill off, literally, the liberals in their diet, and militarized Japan. And in 1937, when they attacked China for the second time, and we were there, and I was standing on the roof garden in the French concession, so it was relatively safe, and about 3 miles away, the Japanese were bombing the south part of Shanghai. And the bombers were Mitsubishi, so I still have a problem if I'm driving down the road and I'm behind a Mitsubishi. What is it? But the Japanese had a name for those big corporations that were cooperating with the government, with the dictatorship, if you will, and they were called Daibatsu. And it wasn't all the corporations of Japan, as we talk about the United States. It was certain big corporations that became part of the government, actually. And if you study the sociology of law, you will learn that large corporations, in fact, are governments. In Seattle, Boeing and Microsoft are small governmental organizations. They have a lot of control over people's lives, and they negotiate with other governments for contracts. And this is happening right now with both of those large corporations. I have a soft place in my heart for those two organizations, which are part of Seattle, and it's hard for me to think that some of the things they do are not really part of free enterprise capitalism. So I saw that bombing in Shanghai and learned that other large corporations in Japan became part of the state apparatus. And the same thing, of course, was happening with Germany. And there's this big list of German corporations that became part of the whole Nazi effort. And these people who were in these corporations wanted power, and they got it. And they wanted money, and they got it. And they wanted power over other people, and they got it. And in China, something that you will not read in your high school history book, and you will not read in your college history book, is that Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists, the Kuomintang, when they marched north in 1927 and were eliminating warlords, and Zhang wanted to conquer all of China, and he did, when he got to Hankou, which is the middle of China, he had a big talk with businessmen, corporate leaders from Shanghai, and they put a deal to Chiang Kai-shek. They said, if you want to come to Shanghai and kill the communists, we'll support you. And Chiang Kai-shek said, why not? So he did. He went to China in 1927-28, killed many of the communists, and the big business then supported him, and China itself became what we call state capitalist, which is a word that's not used in the media, and I'm very glad today to be in the media and be able to say state capitalism, because state capitalism is a part of fascism, and we're developing toward that. One thing that might help us in our discussion is a thumbnail sketch of what happened with American corporations. How did we get to the place where certain corporations can be so dominant and to eliminate competition, especially like in pharmaceuticals, petroleum, and large utilities? And if you listeners want to remember something from this broadcast for later conversation, remember as much as you can. But one thing you might keep in your mind is the date, 1886. In 1886, the Supreme Court of the United States declared that corporations are persons under the U.S. Constitution. They get the rights of the Fifth. and 14th Amendment specifically, they get the right that they should not be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And now, and that's been a disaster, of course. The Sherman Antitrust Act was enacted in 1890, but it's not enforced. We have trusts, and we have combinations and restraint of trade, and we have monopolies, and the law against that is not enforced. In some ways, corporations have more rights than persons in the United States. For example, corporations can't be put in jail. They can be fined, and a lot of them don't mind paying a few million dollars fine. Some of us don't have $1 million, but these corporations regard millions of dollars now as small change. What they're dealing in is billions, as with Halliburton.
I think also something I'd like to point in is, you know, fascism certainly is a strategy and comes down from elites, but it also wells up from the populace. And another part of the fascism that I worry about is that it is a movement within the consciousness of our people. Part of this engineered by 9/11, which puts us in a permanent fear status and tends to give the military the benefit of the doubt, the police technologies and the benefit of the doubt and so forth. But again, I think this is where the Christian right comes in as a shaper of cultural consciousness. An example of that I'd like to give is, you know, as the Nazi Party rose to power, one of the first things it did was to essentially make an alliance. They kind of bought off the Catholic Church, but they also inserted themselves very directly into the state church, the Protestant church of the time, and in a movement called Positive Christianity, which began to fuse the Christian message with the Nazi message. Well, I think the identical thing is happening today with evangelicals and the media church, I would say, and right-wing ideology. And to me, the freshest example of that is this video game that will be coming out in October. And again, those listening, now think of how this shapes the consciousness of a 13-year-old boy, for example. This is a Christian video game, and it takes place in the end times, where the Christians have been supposedly raptured away, and the Antichrist is in charge of the world, and literally all hell is breaking loose. And the object of the game, again, this will be marketed to Christian churches, at least first of all, and then they want it to cross over into the secular realm. But the object of the game is for Christians to join this thing called the Tribulation Force, fighting for good. And they are to convert or kill all the people they meet. So you are with us or you are against us. And if you are against us, you're on the side of the Antichrist and you kill. The video game takes place in New York City, and it's got the latest, greatest in graphics. And what the function, I think, on a consciousness level is it's raising up a whole generation of kids into an apocalyptic kind of holy war, militaristic mentality. And when you begin to research and look at how evangelicals are evangelizing their own kids, discipling, training, apprenticing their own kids, when they go to these massive productions called Battle Cry and Acquire the Fire and these massive spectacles, all of it is surrounded and shrouded in military language. They call it spiritual warfare, but you have Navy SEALs showing up, you have the combat fatigues, you have the world creation being that you are with us or you are against us. And us, we are good and pure and on God's side. And all of them, whether they be liberals or gays or Hindus or Buddhists, whoever is not us, really needs to be eliminated so that the purity of God can once again dominate in the nation and shape the soul of the nation. This kind of training is a prelude to fascism as well. Or matter of fact, I wouldn't say it's the prelude. It's almost the prescripting of fascism. And I think, once again, people need to, both Christians and non-Christians, need to be paying attention to what the right-wing church is saying, particularly to its kids, because it's beginning, just like the Hitler Youth shaped the consciousness of their children. The Christian right and evangelical churches, mega churches, are also shaping the consciousness of a generation yet to come. And that is, to me, also a cause of great concern.